on the record. It's about 9:05 in the morning. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee hearing. Today's date is April 5th, 2012. Today we have four bills before us and confirmation hearing for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. We're going to go real quick to House Bill 180 first, and then after that we'll consider House Bill 304, which makes changes to the membership of the Alaska Standards Fire Council. Then we'll hear House Bill 234, which prohibits picketing within certain distances and times of the funeral services. And finally, if time permits, we'll hear House Bill 169, which addresses Legislative Affairs Agency review of regulations. We'll go first to House Bill 180, which authorizes a veteran's designation on driver's licenses. This would enable veterans to receive the benefits they've earned and are entitled to. It would also provide them with a convenient and easy proof of their status as veterans. We've heard this bill on March 22nd and now have a CS before us. It is version O. Could I have a motion to adopt CS version O for discussion purposes?
So moved.
Thank you. I'll object, and we have Representative Sadler here. And Representative Sadler, if you could put yourself on the record and tell us about some of the changes in the new CS we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 18. Appreciate you. I got a busy schedule. We'll do it quickly if I can. The CS that we have before you adds a provision, a very short provision, to adopt to address the concerns expressed by the Division of Motor Vehicles that while a U.S. flag might be well known in Alaska as a designation of a veteran status, that take that license outside, people might not understand what it means. This simply authorizes the DMV to add the word veteran in addition to the U.S. flag, and it's a good little tweak. I think it's will help the bill.
Great, thank you. And for the record, we have Senator Kukesh, Senator Meyer, and myself, Wolakowski, here. Are there questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, I don't see any. And we're being joined by Senator Giesel. We do have Whitney Brewster on the line, and let's go to Whitney. Whitney, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I'm happy to answer questions. I appreciate the committee and the sponsor adding this additional language. It'll help give the DMV some direction as to what is to be placed on the license and really get to the intent of benefiting Alaska veterans, particularly when they travel outside of Alaska.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any further questions for Whitney? And does the division or the administration support this bill, have concerns about the bill?
Mr. Chairman, the DMV does not have any concerns about the bill, and we support efforts to honor our veterans.
Okay. All right, thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you, Whitney. The bill's before us. Senator Giesel, we just had a brief introduction of the CS by Representative Sadler. Do you have any questions?
I do not.
Any other members have any final questions? I don't see any. What's the will of the committee?
Let's move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate CS for CS for House Bill 180/0. Is that the current one?
It is.
At a committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
All right, thank you. It's a good bill. It's got a further referral. I know they're going to start hearing House bills up in finance very soon. And if there's no objection, the bill is moved. Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's move on to we've got an APOC nominee here, and we don't want to hold him up. They have a meeting at 10 o'clock this morning, so we're going to try to get through that very, very quickly. we have Mr. Vance Sanders of Juneau here. Mr. Sanders, if you could come forward. Thank you for being present. It's always nice to have our nominees before us. I understand that you're from Juneau, you practice law, and I guess you have oral arguments this morning on a case.
10 o'clock.
Thank you. Okay, we'll try to get you out of here as quickly as possible. If you could just put yourself on the record and maybe give us a quick overview of your background and why you would like to serve on APOC.
For the record, my name is Vance Sanders. I live at 9547 North Douglas Highway in Juneau, Alaska. I've been an Alaska resident since the summer of 1984. I came to Alaska right after I graduated from law school and started working with Alaska Legal Services, and I'm still involved with Alaska Legal Services as board president for many years. I have, in my practice, been involved with people from all walks of life all over Alaska, and have really very much enjoyed living in Alaska, and feel that was asked if I would be willing to serve on APOC. I thought it would be an interesting, I guess interesting is the right word, fulfilling, interesting, kind of a different, a little outside the box from my practice, and thought it would be interesting, and I said yes, and so here I am. So I'm happy to continue serving.
And what kind of law do you practice?
I practice a lot of Indian law. I had started that with Alaska Legal Services. I do some benefits work, Medicaid, and qualification for other health insurance work. I do a lot of arbitration, mediation, civil litigation. I've never been a criminal lawyer and don't want to be. I've testified before Senator Pascavan on some Medicaid issues we had a few years back, and in fact a couple times in his committee. So I think he's a little bit more familiar with the work I've done in private practice. But the civil side exclusively, no criminal work, and the last few years I've done more appellate work in federal court and state court. I'm doing a lot more Alaska Supreme Court work at this point, and kind of transitioning to that part of the practice.
Okay, and for the record, we're joined by Senator Pasfan. We're hearing from Mr. Sanders about his APOC nomination. He's got a oral argument in a case.
Across the street, Your Honor. Sir, Mr. Chair, I'll save Your Honor for 10 o'clock.
Are there questions for the nominee? Senator Giesel.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sanders, how will serving on APOC, affect your practice?
I think it will require me to scale back a little bit, but I had intended to do that anyway. My wife and I have three children. Our middle child will be going off to college this fall, and we have a daughter who's going to be an exchange student to Sweden. She leaves in August for a year. So my parental responsibilities are going to be changing in any event, and this just so I had intended to scale back some, and I just think that this would be an interesting thing to do at this point in my life, and so I think it will affect it, but not in a way that's unanticipated, and I plan to scale back. I don't intend to add to my current caseload. I tend to do less legal work at this point, so that's how I tend to adjust to that.
Thank you,
ma'am.
All right. Have you had an opportunity to observe much of APOC? Do you have any?
Truthfully, I haven't. I've been going on a Civil War battle tour, and I went to the Final Four in New Orleans this weekend, and I got a big packet of stuff. I got back yesterday, and I haven't even had time to look at all the information I've gotten from APOC yet. But I'm friends with Elizabeth Hickerson, who's the chair. In fact, she's the reason I'm in Alaska. Her husband recruited me to come to Alaska for Alaska Legal Services, 1983. So I know Ms. Hickerson, the chair, and she's told me a bit about how the APOC works. But the answer to the question, Senator, is I haven't observed the meetings.
Senator Kukesh, did you have a question?
Yeah, no comment. Anybody who goes to the Final Four should get unanimous.
Well, let's just say my Tar Heel senator did not make it that far, thanks to a wrist injury. But
well, that's also good too. And that's something I vote for.
Well, that works.
I just want to say I've never had a personal relationship with Mr. Sanders, but for most of my life, I've heard of him and heard of the work he's done in the Native community and the work that he's been responsible for. And I really appreciate the work, and I appreciate your contribution to the legal profession in Alaska. Thank you much for that.
Thank you, sir.
And if you do get confirmed, I'm sure you'll do very well on the APOC board. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Do you have any, by now you've probably had the opportunity to fill out your lengthy public disclosure form?
I have not.
Oh, okay.
I got an email, frankly, Senator, got an email while I was away, but I decided, I think it was when I was touring the Shiloh battlefield, and I decided to wait on that, so I haven't done that yet.
And as a practicing attorney, I'm sure Senator Pasfan can talk to you about the fun that will be. Do you have any suggestions, ways, directions you want to see APOC go, or any changes you'd like to see? Do we need to have anything that comes to your mind?
Senator, the only thing that I'm aware of, I've heard from, since people have heard that I had applied for and may be appointed to or confirmed to be appointed to the AIPOC, a few lawyer friends of mine have suggested that everything AIPOC does be online. I don't have personal knowledge of what is and what isn't online because this has been so new, and it came at a time when I planned the trip I just talked about. But that's the one comment that I've received, is that everything should be, you know, in an effort to be transparent, it should all be online so that folks can get that. And I don't really know at this point what is and what isn't, but that's what the feedback that I've received. But other than that, I really have no personal knowledge of.
All right. Any further questions? Okay. Could I? There's nothing further. Any final statements you'd like to make?
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Could I get a motion to forward the name of Vance Sanders as a nominee to the Alaska Public Offices Commission to a joint session of the legislature for consideration? Such a motion, or approval of such a motion, would not indicate intent on the part of any individual member to vote for or against Mr. Sanders' confirmation.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Is there any objection? Okay, I don't see any. All right, congratulations. We're going to forward your name on to a vote of the full body next Tuesday.
Thank you. Doc.
Great, thank you.
Please be excused.
Yep. Okay, let's move on to House Bill. Just one second. Let's take a brief at ease. And we had another nomination before us, that of Dr. David Eichler, and I have my staffer, Michelle. Michelle, if you could just tell us what information you've heard about his nomination.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michelle Seideman, and I serve as staff to you in this committee. And I did receive a call this morning from Mr. Jason Hooley, who is the director of the boards and commissions section for Governor Parnell, and he did inform me that the name of Dr. David Eichler is being withdrawn for consideration to serve on the AIPOC board.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Michelle. Okay, let's move on now to House Bill 304. The bill makes several changes to the composition of the Alaska Fire Standards Council. We have Aaron Shine, staff to Representative Johnson, here to present the bill. Aaron, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee. If you could put yourself on the record, give us an overview of the bill.
All right. Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Shine, and I am staff to Representative Craig Johnson. The bill before you today is House Bill 304, which makes three simple changes to the existing membership of the Alaska Fire Standards Council. The first change is designating an existing seat to a member of the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. The second change is adding a member adding a seat for a member of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. And the third change is reclassifying an existing seat from a firefighter administrator officer to a member of the Alaska State Firefighters Association. The mission of the Alaska Fire Standards Council is to establish professional standards for fire service personnel and the curriculum requirements for the certification of training programs. Under House Bill 304, the governor will appoint one member from each of these associations to the Alaska Fire Standards Council from a list of at least three nominees submitted by each association. The intent of House Bill 304 is to ensure that all three associations are represented on the Alaska Fire Standards Council and to guarantee that each of these designees from these three statewide firefighting associations will speak with the full confidence of their associations in council meetings. Thank you for considering this piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I can answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Aaron, I'm counting here, and it sounds like there are 12 members with these new folks. So it'll make 12 members on the board?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that is correct. It will be a 12-member board. Currently, it's 11-member board. With that, on March 11th, when the Fire Standards Council met to deliberate on adding these seats and making these changes, the council decided that in the event of a full council for a vote, the chairman would abstain from voting.
Okay, to create the odd number.
Correct.
Excellent. Could I ask a follow-up question,
Absolutely.
Please? So what is the rationale for these changes? I mean, why do we need another member who's the Alaska Fire Chief Association? And
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, from my understanding is there are members that are serving on the Alaska Fire Standards Council, but they're not appointed as members of their associations. By doing this, by making these changes, they will be able to speak with the full confidence of their associations. They're bringing their training information, because this is for the curriculum requirements for the safety of firefighters and professionals throughout the state. Through that, they would be able to speak on behalf of their associations. And I believe online we do have, I should have noted this before, Eric Lawson from the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, Jeff Tucker from the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, and I believe Robert Denard from the Alaska State Firefighters Association, so they could probably answer specific questions if you have those.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for the bill sponsor? I don't see any. Let's go to public testimony. We've got Jeff Tucker online. Jeff, if you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Tucker. I'm the fire chief for the North Star Fire Department in North Pole, Alaska. I'm also the immediate past president of the Alaska State Fire Chiefs Association, and I'm calling in support of this piece of legislation. To echo what Aaron said, what this legislation does, currently the Alaska State Firefighters Association has a seat on the Fire Standards Council. With this bill, it'll allow the other two professional the other two state organizations who represent firefighters, the Alaska Fire Chiefs and the Professional Firefighters Association, to also have a seat on there. What this does, while there might be members of our various associations who serve on this body, by having an individual who is a designated representative for us, they can report back to us. We can then, through them, have a more direct influence on this very important Standards Council that affects, you know, what we do in Alaska for the fire service. So we feel our involvement, the ability that we have to, you know, lend information and participate on this on Alaska Fire Standards Council is critical to, you know, the services we provide as through the State Fire Chiefs Association. So we encourage the passage of this legislation, and I'll stand by for any questions.
Any questions? All right, thank you, Jeff. I don't see any questions. Appreciate your time. Is there anyone else online? I don't see anyone. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? I don't see anyone. We're going to close public testimony. Any last words, Aaron?
Mr. Chairman, no, unless you have specific questions.
Okay, great. Thank you. Final questions? I don't see any. Okay, we're going to set the bill aside. If members have any amendments, please get them to Michelle by Friday. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on. Next bill up is House Bill 234, which would prohibit picketing 1 hour before or after a funeral. Picketing would be prohibited within 150 feet of where service is taking place. I understand that 46 other states have passed laws similar to this. We have Aaron Schroeder, staff to Representative Bill Thomas, here to present the bill. Aaron, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I'm Aaron Schroeder, staff to Representative Thomas. As you previously stated, House Bill 234 would regulate protests that would occur in the state of Alaska. 46 other states have currently similar legislation in place for such cases. Under this bill, it would set guidelines of 150-foot buffer for 1 hour before, during, and one hour after the funeral. In order to fall under this bill, an individual would have to meet the definition of picketing within the time constraints, within the distance. They'd have to disrupt the funeral, and they'd have to show reckless disregard for doing so. So there's five acts. All must be committed in order to fall under this statute. The penalty would be disorderly conduct, Class B misdemeanor, would carry a penalty of no more than 10 days in jail and a $2,000 fine. And I also want to point out to the committee that the Alaska Peace Officers Association has submitted a letter of support.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the testimony. Good bill. My only question is, has this been a problem in Alaska yet?
This is a preemptive piece of legislation. There's no been, has not been any protest that I'm aware of.
Okay, that's great. And then, is there any concerns with the First Amendment with this bill? Freedom of speech?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. That's an open-ended question. There is. Do you have a more specific?
This bill's been going through the committee process, and I just was wondering what opposition has there been to the bill. It seems like a good common sense bill. The only thing I can think of is perhaps somebody would argue that it limits your freedom of speech.
To the chair, Senator Meyer, it does regulate free speech, but again, only within the confines that I described earlier. This isn't the first time that we've regulated free speech as federally or states, so we think it's an appropriate middle ground for respect for the families and for somebody to express their freedom of speech.
Very good. And Mr. Chairman, I agree 100% with you. And obviously, if it's been passed in 46 other states, I'm sure that has been challenged and upheld. So thank you.
We do. Yes, Senator Passman.
I was just wondering if there is any less restrictive, obviously the term free speech isn't free if you're restricting it. And so is there any less restrictive application than criminalization that was considered?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, not particularly. When we went through the process of drafting this bill, we've actually decided on a less restrictive version than most other states. A lot of the other states were much more aggressive with both distance and how broad it was. So we backed off of that a little bit, and we felt as the state of Alaska, if this bill were to pass, we would be less, as you stated, than a lot of the other states were, if that answers your question.
Well, in other words, what I'm wondering is there, through a permitting process, to see whether it might be appropriate or something, in other words, I'm addressing the issue of the actual criminalization of the speech itself, and that's the question, is was there something less restrictive than criminalization that was considered?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, no. Just to answer your question, we didn't consider that. We thought this was an appropriate step, needless to say, though.
Just one last. Have the laws in the other states been challenged?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, there has been a number of challenges. Each case is unique in its own right. The language that we drafted from this bill is drafted from language that has been upheld in the state of Ohio, and also we modeled the distance after the federal statute. So the federal there is a federal statute similar to this in place for the national cemeteries, and so we feel pretty confidently that if challenged, that this bill would hold up.
We do have Doug Gardner. From Legislative Legal Online, and if you're done, Aaron, we can go to Mr. Gardner. Doug, are you there?
I am, Senator.
Can you put yourself on the record? There are some questions. Senator Meyer had some questions. Senator Passman had some questions. Maybe you could give us a quick overview of whether you think this would be legal, whether you think this violates the First Amendment.
Certainly, Senator Wilikowski. My name is Doug Gardner. I'm Director of Legal Services for the Alaska State Legislature, and I have worked with the sponsor in doing the drafting work on this bill. perhaps a maybe to start, when I tuned in, I heard Senator Pasvan asking the sponsor's representative how the bill was, or there were less restrictive alternatives discussed. And I think that in the context of the criminal statutes that were reviewed in drafting this bill, the effort was made to make the bill content neutral, to tailor it in the time, place, and manner and scope with the sponsor as narrowly as possible, recognizing that communities in Alaska and some places are much smaller than they are in other areas. My recollection is that the distances in this statute are less, as I think that Mr. Schroeder mentioned, than they are in other states, just recognizing that there may be communities that don't have a main street that is particularly long, and so there was a recognition that Alaska is a little bit different. I wanted to point out also in response to Senator Pasvan's argument, certainly observing that whenever you're regulating speech, litigation is likely to come. However, the if a person were protesting or doing something at a funeral, as long as the protester's communication isn't directed at the burial service, I mean, if you held up a sign that didn't perhaps have a slogan on it like those in the Snyder case, but was directed at a different issue or was not disruptive, the statute wouldn't necessarily bar that activity. The statute is directed at communications that are intended to disrupt a burial service during the times in question. So it doesn't, the statute doesn't prevent some demonstration at appropriate times, and it doesn't blanket eliminate all speech, albeit that it does regulate speech that is disruptive of the service. So those are the considerations, I think, that went into making it as narrowly tailored as possible through the chair, Senator Pasvan.
Thank you, Doug. Doug, let me ask you another question. If there is a funeral going on and there is a protest for something different, you know, we've seen all protests last year by various organizations. So the protest isn't aimed at this incident, but it perhaps disturbs the funeral. Would this take in that conduct as well?
Senator Wilkowski, let's say, for example, that there was a protest there are demonstrations during the session out in front of the Capitol on a fairly regular basis. I'm not aware of the exact distances, but let's say that there is a funeral service at a church close enough to be captured within this distances in this bill. And let's say people are protesting out in front of the Capitol about pay increases, and there's some volume to it. As long as those protests are not directed at disrupting the funeral, I believe that that would not be actionable, and there would not be an unintended overlap that would cause those people to be cited or otherwise charged.
And just on that point, just looking at the definition of picketing, on page 3, lines 18 and 19, it describes picketing as protest activities engaged in by a person that disrupt or are undertaken to disturb a funeral. So in the case that you mentioned, and it's actually a very good example, Capitol Steps, there's a protest going on for higher wages, let's say, and there happens to be a funeral going on within 150 feet. The way I read this is doesn't have to necessarily be undertaken to disturb a funeral. But if it merely disrupts the funeral, then it meets the definition of picketing, the way I'm reading this. Am I wrong?
Senator Wilkowski, I don't think you're wrong. I think that when you look at the cases that have, in my recollection is this was based on a Sixth Circuit or an Eighth Circuit case in a statute from the relevant state. But I think when you look at the backdrop of the case law interpreting and otherwise the intention of the other statutes, I think that the focus has to be on disrupting a particular the funeral, not just because it has a spillover effect. There was a passage from a Sixth Circuit case that I circled when I testified in front of another committee, and this is what the court observed in Phelps-Roper versus Strickland in 539 Fed 3rd 356. The court said, thus properly read, the funeral protest provision restricts only the time and place of speech directed at a funeral or burial service. If a protester's communication is not directed at a funeral or burial service, the mere fact that one holds a picket sign within 300 feet of a funeral or burial service during the relevant time period without more will not support a conviction under the relevant statute that's cited there. And so I think that there, you know, obviously you could get into a situation where an overzealous law enforcement situation resulted in a citation, but I don't believe that the statute and the language that you've identified is designed to cover other activities that might otherwise affect but aren't directed at a funeral. I think the intent of the, at least as I understood it, the sponsor's intent was only to capture conduct that's directed directly at the funeral.
Let me, if we change that language and said picketing means protest activities engaged in by a person undertaken to disrupt or disturb a funeral, would that tighten it up a little bit?
Senator Wilkowski, I think that if the committee believes that that tightens it up, I'm hesitating because one of the things that I think that when you get into these types of cases where litigation is going to be heavily focused on the language and focused on other precedent, I think that there probably would be a desire by lawyers litigating this to have language that has been addressed in other cases. And if you start changing the language, then I think that it probably becomes a more fertile area for litigation. This particular language has been given a fairly narrow construction by at least the court that I mentioned that looked at it, and I would just make the observation that language that has been interpreted before is sometimes desirable, but I wouldn't say your language is bad. I'm just observing that it's different and it may have an unintended consequence of triggering some litigation that might otherwise not happen under the language that's here.
Have there been any Ninth Circuit or Alaska courts that have looked at this? Because you're citing a Sixth Circuit, which is, I think, in the Midwest somewhere.
Most of the litigation, Senator Wilkowski, most of the litigation in the country has been driven by particular groups located more within the Midwest, and I think that's why the cases come from there. I don't recall any funeral protest case in Alaska. I have not looked in the Ninth Circuit for some time. This bill was drafted last session, and I don't recall a Ninth Circuit case right now, but I could be corrected on that. But I'm just not aware of one sitting here right now.
Okay. Senator Pasadena has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm not a constitutional attorney, but I'm trying to, you know, my general understanding is that in order to survive a constitutional challenge to a restriction imposed on free speech, one has to consider the least restrictive methods of limiting speech. And particularly I'm focused on Section 2, which makes it a crime. Is there a least or a less restrictive methodology other than making it a crime that, you know, might apply here? In other words, a penalty, a monetary penalty, for example, as compared to criminalization?
Through the chair, Senator Pasadena, I think that that's certainly a policy call. I think that obviously there's everything from a violation, which would not be considered a criminal conviction. This happens to be, as I recall it, a B misdemeanor. But I don't know that the outcome, if there's a restriction on speech, there's a restriction on speech, and the outcome a criminal outcome if you're if what you're getting at is that is even a more of a deterrent to speech, notwithstanding the restrictions, but then the fact coupled with that that there's a criminal consequence. I mean, I could see that a court might give that consideration and find that that is a chilling on speech, but it would be a policy consideration as to how the legislature wanted to address that, and it could be reduced to a violation. It could be reduced to, and if it was reduced to a violation, then it would be tantamount to making it a fine situation.
And again, I'm just trying to focus upon, I think that at least it needs to be discussed and debated as to whether there are, when one makes a policy decision, methods that might be least restrictive. And if you're looking at this from the position of a protester potentially, and again in a content neutral manner, how do you know that you're becoming a criminal as compared to if you're wrong, you're just subject to a fine?
Through the chair, Senator Pascal, one thing I would note is that in the most recent U.S. Supreme Court expression on this issue in Snyder versus Phelps, that case was a tort lawsuit, and so it was a very different analysis of speech. But in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court did throw a one line in recognizing that there has been this litigation in the context of state criminal statutes regulating funeral picketing, and the court did say that to the extent that these laws are content neutral, in other words, referring to state laws that are criminal, they raise very different questions from the tort issue that was before the court in the Maryland Snyder case. And the court seemed to be sending the message that a different analysis might be applied by the U.S. Supreme Court in looking at speech and the government's interest in placing content-neutral and narrowly drawn restrictions on speech as it related to balancing the rights of free speech against the rights or interests of privacy and other interests related to funeral mourners. And the court sounded like it was sending at least a subtle message that it would be receptive to considering government action that regulated speech in order to protect certain individuals during times of grief. So I know that that's an oblique answer to your question, but I think that, you know, that's an understatement, but I think that there certainly is some expression by the Supreme Court that states may be able to regulate this to protect some of their citizens at certain narrow times, and as long as the statutes are narrowly construed.
Senator Passman.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm bringing that up is that I think that from a policymaking standpoint, we at least have to have put these issues on the table so that they were considered as compared to not discussed, which then I think potentially opens up an issue even more that it wasn't even considered.
I think anytime you talk about taking away people's right to free speech, you have to do a pretty serious analysis, and that's, I think, what we're doing, and appreciate the conversation. Let me ask you a question, Doug, if someone is protesting a military funeral, and let's say there are two sets of people there within 150 feet, one set of people is protesting against the military, and there's another group of people who are saying, we support the military and we should honor the military. Are both of those people violating the law?
Senator Wilkowski, the statute, to the extent that you had a group that was pro and one that was con, so to speak, I think in your hypothetical.
Yes.
If they were both trying to express their views in a way that disrupted the funeral, I think that both could receive a citation. I don't think that the statute is designed to favor one particular type of speech over the other. A lot of the result may depend on some law enforcement decisions, but the way the statute's presented, it's designed in such a way that both sides could be cited if they're disrupting a funeral.
And I think what that goes to is what is the heart of protest activities, and that's on page 3, lines 18. Is there a definition of protest activities? Do you know if the courts have interpreted that somewhere?
I don't have that information available, if there is. I think that the statutes have just directed that towards noise and volume of sound and activities that are designed to be disruptive, but I don't have an answer for you on that at the moment, but I can look and provide the committee with an answer.
Okay. Any other questions for Doug? I don't see any. Doug, could you hold on the line for a few more minutes? Because sure. We're, I think, going to get the opposing viewpoint right now from Jeff Mittman of the ACLU. Jeff, are you on the line?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Could you put yourself on the record and give us your testimony? Thank you for the letter you sent us. It's in the committee packet.
My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I am the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska, and I thank the chair of the committee for the opportunity to testify with regard to HB 234. We have previously provided to the committee rather extensive written testimony regarding the constitutional legal issues we see with this bill. I do want to reiterate at the outset that the ACLU neither condones nor endorses the viewpoints of those individuals who we are aware of through press reports and most are aware of, who have engaged in expressive activity at funerals. Their views, I think, are universally thought to be abhorrent. The way they conduct themselves and the manner in which they choose to express those views are not what any rational or polite person would choose to do in public. That being said, as the committee has noted, the First Amendment is a fundamental protector of rights that go to the core of a democracy, and that is the rights of free speech. We do best to protect the rights of all to engage in appropriate political dialogue by ensuring that those unpopular opinions expressed in unpopular manners are also protected. Of course, I think one of the landmark examples of this is when the ACLU back in the 1970s defended the rights of Nazis to march in Skokie, where there were a number of Holocaust survivors who lived. It is not then that the ACLU supported the viewpoint or the way that it was being expressed. It is simply that the First Amendment can only mean anything if it protects all speech, not just popular speech. And that being said, we go into a fairly great detail with what we believe are significant constitutional infirmities with the bill as it is drafted. As the most recent question just pointed out, as drafted, picketing means protest activities. We would contend that, in fact, in the example just queried, with two groups at a funeral, one supporting a military funeral and the military, and one opposing or protesting the military, clearly drafting indicates that that group protesting or opposing the military would come under the rubric of the statute as drafted. That group supporting or not protesting the military would not come under, and that is the crux of why this is not content neutral. I think what the ACLU would recommend, and we'd be happy to work with the drafter and the sponsors, is there is certain conduct that is clearly can come within reasonable and First Amendment permitted restrictions. So, for example, if any individual were to engage in conduct that essentially disturbed the peace, shouting or conducting noisy activity outside a funeral or outside a church that was so loud that it disrupted, whether or not it was pro or against, whether or not it expressed a popular viewpoint or not, that sort of conduct could easily be prohibited, not because it represented a viewpoint, but because it did so in a manner that crossed the reasonable time, place, and manner threshold that the courts have always held are open to restrictions. Conversely, the most heinous, the most disgusting, the most foul language that was presented on a sign near a funeral, and that was even a subject to being seen even just temporarily by attendees at a funeral, that conduct is and always will be protected by the First Amendment. What we'd like to do is work with the drafter on narrowly tailoring a bill that followed the constitutional outlines of a large degree of case law that shows how First Amendment speech can be protected. With that, I will answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Jeff. Senator Pastorin has a question.
You know, earlier I had questions as far as the criminalization as compared to a violation or a fine. Is that a concern, or is am I going back to too much constitutional law more than 30-some years ago now?
Through the chair, Senator Pastorin, it is a concern. We believe where there are criminal penalties that apply, it is likely that the courts would, in fact, give even higher scrutiny. As has been testified, the leading case that went up to the Supreme Court was on a civil matter, and again, the court very clearly stated, although the expressive conduct was disgusting, the manner in which it was engaged in was abhorrent, it was still protected, and that was whether or not civil liability would apply. Where there are criminal penalties that apply to First Amendment activity, what the courts would likely do is look at the chilling effect of the regulation. Clearly, one who engages in protected First Amendment activity should not be exposed to the potential chilling factor that one is subject to criminal penalties. So we would argue that criminal penalties apply make this more likely, not less likely, to be subject to scrutiny and to be found unconstitutional.
All right, other questions? Senator Buesel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The First Amendment right to free speech is not universally protected. A person crying fire in a crowded theater or making inappropriate comments on an aircraft that's in flight are arrested. In AS 1161, 110A, number 2, it describes disrupting the peace and privacy of another. It is a crime of disorderly conduct, as described in that statute, and clearly is not being appropriately applied for these funerals, though the effect is the same as is being added in definition number 8. Isn't that true?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. Again, the time, place, and matter restriction is a common exception to First Amendment protection. So, for example, in our earlier testimony, we stated there is a way to draft that gets at noise that is, as pointed out in subsection 2, is quote-unquote unreasonably loud. The problem with section 8 is that it states the person knowingly engaged in picketing with reckless disregard that picketing occurs. Then when one refers to Section 3 and the definition of picketing, it states, picketing means protest activities engaged in by a person that disrupt or undertake to disturb a funeral. Thus, picketing could be silent side-holding, which disrupts or disturbs a funeral by the content of the message. So silent picketing could be encompassed in subsection 8 through the definition. That is not disturbing the peace or unreasonably loud noise, and we are not aware of a court decision that states that silent picketing could come within the ambit of reasonable time, place, or manner. For example, shouting fire in a crowded theater represents a danger to harm to individuals. Silent picketing that is offensive, the sort of danger it represents or the sort of harm it represents is emotional harm, but that generally would not fall within a time, place, or manner restriction analysis.
Any other questions for Mr. Mittman? Jeff, thank you for your testimony and for the documents you've provided us. I think the bill may need to be tightened up a little bit, so I would encourage you to work with my office and with the bill sponsor, and maybe we can tighten it up a little bit. I'm a little concerned about page 3, the definition of picketing. I think it is a little bit bit broader than needs to be. I think we can tighten it up and still achieve the same result that the sponsor is looking at. Senator Pasternak?
Actually, if Mr. Mittman is he still available?
Are you still online, Jeff?
I am, Mr. Chair.
If there were, and I've been to several military funerals, if there was the involvement of government at that funeral through a color guard or I don't know what it's called with the 21-gun salute, does that potentially increase or decrease the level of scrutiny that a court would consider? In other words, as compared to just the family at the funeral.
Through the chair, Senator Pascal, that's a good question, and that is something we'd have to research. I would not want to opine without doing a little research as to what additional requirements may be present with regard to the presence of a military detachment.
Right. Senator Myers' question.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, does this committee have a, or this, does this bill have a judiciary referral?
Yeah.
Yes. It sounds like most of the questions we have are judiciary related, but I think on a statewide policy, I think we all are in agreement that this is very offensive and want to tighten it up some. So I don't know if we want to make the changes here or if it's more appropriate in judiciary, but it's up to you, Mr. Chairman.
It's a fair point. And we've got two out of the five members of the Judiciary Committee on this committee, yeah. So it's a fair point. Why don't we have, let's see if there's any other public testimony. Anyone else online? No. Anyone else in the room? No. We'll close public testimony. I think it's been a good discussion. I think anytime you delve into free speech and constitutional issues, it's interesting and you have to tread very carefully. I do think it's a good bill. I do agree with Senator Meyer. There's some good public policy here. But at the same time, we just want to be very careful whenever we go in and try to take away people's rights to free speech. So we're going to hold the bill. If members have amendments, if you could get them to Michelle by the end of Friday, it would be appreciated. All right, thanks, Aaron. Okay, next up, we'll go to House Bill 169, which addresses the Legislative Affairs Agency review of regulations. We have from Representative Gatto's staff, Melanie Lesh, here to describe the bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Melanie Lesh. I'm representing the House Judiciary Committee, who is the sponsor of House Bill 169. In contrast to your last bill, House Bill 169 is unopposed and not controversial, and we have Lisa Kirsch still on the teleconference to answer any more detailed questions, but I'll give you a quick overview. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill is a quick and simple fix to two minor problems in an otherwise functioning regulation review system. Statutes covering legislative legal services review of proposed agency regulations, which are AS 2420-105, those are subject to the Admin Reg Review Admin Procedures Act, which is under AS 4462. Our statutes, the legislative's review statutes, currently list those who can request a review of regulations from legal services, and they are a standing committee, the Admin Reg Review Committee, and Legislative Council. So the same statute also limits those who legal services is allowed to notify of the results of the review, and that is the Admin Reg Review Committee, President of the Senate, and Speaker of the House. Simply, those lists do not match. So, additionally, legal services can only notify these entities if the regulations fail to meet the statutory standards. So what this bill does is we add the committee or council that requested the review to the list of those who can receive the notice. We also, if the regulation implements newly enacted legislation, legal services may consult with and notify the prime sponsor of the legislation if that prime sponsor is still serving in the legislature. And finally, it allows legal services to notify the requester that the regulations meet the statutory standards. And that concludes my overview.
All right, thank you. Questions? I don't see any. We've got Lisa Kirsch online. Lisa, welcome to the committee. Could you put yourself on the record? Lisa, are you there? Lisa Kirsch?
Yes, I am.
Could you put yourself on the record? And I don't know if you have prepared testimony. It looks like you're signed up for questions.
My name is Lisa Kirsch. I am a drafting attorney at Legislative Legal Services. I am here to answer questions. I do not have any prepared testimony.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Ms. Kirsch? Any comments on, do you believe this is a necessary bill? Do you think this will solve problems, create problems? Do you have any opinion?
I was formerly doing the regs review and worked with the Administrative Regs Review Committee. This does correct a problem. It's not something that has arisen very often, but there are those situations where, there are three factors that we look at under Section D, subsection D of this provision that we're amending. It allows us to look for legality, constitutionality, whether the agency that's preparing the regulations has statutory authority, whether the regulations are consistent with existing statutes. And then there's the fourth factor that comes up under subsection F, which is whether it's consistent with legislative intent. And in the context of that particular concern, and it is most often come up, shouldn't the sponsor who put this bill forward, if it is, in fact, not an amendment of existing regulations that have been in the regs for a long time, but it is like a new set of regs relating to newly enacted legislation, very often the Regs Review Committee would say, well, shouldn't the sponsor know about this? And so it has come up occasionally. It's not a problem that comes up every time. The vast majority of the regs we are reviewing over here tend to be amendments to existing regs, but there are some that are related to newly enacted legislation. So in that context, it makes good sense. And then, of course, as was previously mentioned, if a standing committee has the ability to request review, but we would do the review and the only people we could release to were, the speaker, the president, and the Regs Review Committee, which seemed kind of strange because, of course, the standing committee who requested the review would be waiting for a response. So, that I think is a more obvious needed change, but I think the other change is useful as well.
All right, thank you. And I'll just say I am a member of the Admin Reg Review Committee. I know this issue did come up. It seemed the bill that's proposed did seem to be one that the committee seemed to think was a good idea. Questions? All right, I don't see any. Thank you, Ms. Kirsch. Is there anyone else online wanting to testify? I don't see any. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? I don't see any. We'll close public testimony. Anything in wrap up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're going to close the hearing and we'll set the bill aside. The bill has a zero fiscal note. It does have a further referral to judiciary. If members have any proposed amendments, please get them to Michelle by the end of Friday. And with that, we're adjourned.